Welcome to the Digital Identity Digest, the audio companion to the blog at Spherical Cow Consulting. I'm Heather Flanagan, and every week I break down interesting topics in the field of digital identity, from credentials and standards to browser weirdness and policy twists. If you work with digital identity but don't have time to follow every specification or hype cycle, you're in the right place. Let's get into it. Hi there, and welcome back to a Digital Identity Digest. In today's episode, I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think of when someone says digital identity? Do you think of biometrics, login credentials, a string of JSON data, your social media account? Well, the answer probably depends on where you are, how old you are, how tech savvy you are. It's at least in part about what cultural context you're coming from. We often talk about digital identity, though, like it's this universal construct, something we can standardize, serialize, and slot in neatly into global frameworks. But identity is just as cultural as it is technical. And when we ignore that, we risk building trust frameworks that look great on paper and fail spectacularly in practice because of what the designers think of were quote-unquote edge cases. So let's start with some basics. Identity isn't one thing. Most digital identity systems bundle together a set of assumptions that identity is persistent, for example, that it's singular, that it's owned and controlled by the individual, that it's useful primarily for authorization or for reputation. But none of these are universal truths. They're artifacts. They reflect the cultural and historical norms of particular regions, most often the US and Europe, where those systems were first designed. Now, I had a lot of fun digging into this topic because while I've seen these cultural assumptions crop up in standards work and deployments, I kind of wanted to back this up with some actual research, not just anecdotes. Enter in Ketelin Fair, and I'm really hoping I'm saying their name correctly. So Fair conducted a comparative study of digital identity and online self-management strategies looking at users in Central and Eastern Europe and Southeast Asia. So there were 60 in-depth interviews, half with students, half with business leaders. I mean, there was some solid qualitative work in here. And the differences she found were not small. For many Southeast Asian users, digital identity is framed as something external. It's an account. It's a tool to manage reputation, maybe to access services. It's instrumental and pragmatic. It's not really you. It's something you use. But in Central and Eastern Europe, here's much more of a blend. Your digital self is seen as an extension of your real self. A digital footprint isn't just metadata. It is, in fact, part of your identity. It's how you see yourself. It's something you curate, something you express, something personal. Neither approach is right or wrong, but each one shapes expectations about how digital identity systems should work and who should be in control of those systems. And that brings us to design. Because cultural values don't just show up in user behavior, they show up in system architecture as well. So Western identity models tend to assume a few core things. First, that the individual owns and controls their identity. Second, that transparency and auditability are inherently good things. And third, that consent, especially informed consent, is the key to making the whole thing trustworthy. And those assumptions align very well with societies that prioritize personal autonomy and individual accountability. They've become the foundation for many of today's digital identity frameworks. But in collectivist or hierarchical structure, that logic shifts a little bit. Trust may flow more through institutions or family networks, not individuals. Reputation might be governed by social harmony, not by audit trails. And consent might be implicit or negotiated through relationships, not terms of service. So what happens when you try and roll out a single identity model that across that spectrum of beliefs? Well, you get resistance. People try to work around the system or they don't use it at all. And this is something we see again and again. So let's look at the people actually building these systems. One of the biggest challenges in designing standards that reflect cultural diversity is that the standards development community itself doesn't reflect much in the way of diversity. Let's take the IETF, for example, the Internet Engineering Task Force. They published some great data on community participation, and according to their 2023 survey, nearly 80% of IETF participants came from North America or Europe, and 85% identified as male. Most were fluent in English, which makes sense since English is the only language used for IETF meetings, mailing lists, and documents, which absolutely helps streamline communication, but it filters out others who might meaningfully participate. So when the rooms where identity standards, among other things, are built, when those rooms lack regional or linguistic or gender diversity, the resulting standards tend to reflect the assumptions of the people already in the room. And no matter how well-intentioned those people may be, that's a problem. We've watched what happens when identity systems built around one cultural model are deployed in places that follow another. I mean, sometimes it's friction, sometimes it's outright rejection. Let's poke up for a moment at the whole concept of digital wallets. In Western cultures, digital wallets are usually tied to the idea of personal control. One person, one device. You hold your credentials and no one else touches them. But in parts of Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, phones are often shared among family members, among friends, even across small communities. So if your system assumes each person has exclusive access to a smartphone, right there it starts to break down pretty fast. You're creating barriers instead of removing them, and access becomes more difficult, not less. Then let's look at facial recognition. In the US and Europe, that's a lightning rod for privacy debates, but it's still widely deployed. In other parts of the world, especially places with recent histories of surveillance or ethnic targeting, that's not just controversial. I mean, it is actively distrusted by pretty much everybody involved. Even if the implementation is secure, even if the data stays local, the issue isn't just technical, it's cultural. It's about the legacy of how people have seen this technology used in the past. And then here's one that's been around forever, naming. A lot of digital identity systems still require a first name and a last name in Latin characters, and that's fine if your culture works that way, but plenty don't. Some people use single names. Others rely on patronymics. Others use scripts that don't map cleanly to Latin characters. When those systems force users to conform to provide a quote-unquote acceptable name just to get through whatever form they're trying to fill out, they erase real aspects of who people are and the trust that people might have in the systems. And those are not minor edge cases. These are all indicators that show us where cultural mismatch can break otherwise well-meaning systems and the trust that they're trying to engender. They remind us that identity isn't actually neutral. It carries weight, and that weight can't be standardized away. So what do we do about it? What we need are trust frameworks that are more regionally adaptable, systems that can flex to local norms without giving up interoperability. And no, that doesn't mean throwing away global standards. That would be crazy talk. It means designing with flexibility in mind, separating the cultural mechanisms from the cultural assumptions. So what would that look like? Well, one option is modular trust anchors, for example. Instead of hard coding one list of trustworthy issuers, let regions define their own. Governments, civil society organizations, even private sector entities can play that role depending on local needs. Another tool is flexible disclosure. Instead of requiring full data dumps every time a credential is presented, let users reveal just what's needed. Minimal disclosure, selective proof. It's not only better for privacy, it also allows for cultural variance in what people are willing to share. And finally, think about standardized semantics with localized governance. We can agree on data formats and protocols while leaving room for different rules about who can issue credentials, how they're used, and what legal status they carry. Now, these ideas aren't hypothetical. They're already surfacing in conversations around decentralized identity, verifiable credentials, and wallet interoperability. But they do need more support and more cultural intelligence, I think, to succeed. So there's a great paper I read recently called Culture and Society in the Digital Age by Levin and Mamlock. They talk about how digital systems are shaping human experience, not just by offering tools, but by encoding certain worldviews. Now, their warning in that paper is that if we aren't careful, we'll end up with digital experiences that kind of flatten human difference. They kind of push everyone towards one way of interacting, one model of being, and that would include how we define and manage digital identity. So if we replicate that flattening in digital identity systems, diversity won't be a feature, it will be a bug, something to be worked around, and that is not the world we should be building towards. We're creating the infrastructure of digital personhood, and that's a big job. If we want that infrastructure to support real people and not just these tiny models we put together, we have to let it speak in more than one voice. That means more than just building flexible architectures. It means actively bringing more voices into the room where those architectures are shaped. If cultural norms differ, and we know they do, then we need people who live those norms to help define what trustworthy, usable, empowering identity looks like. Otherwise, we're not building local systems. We're just exporting our personal assumptions. And that means we're not building trust. Trust doesn't scale unless it can adapt. And adaptation, that doesn't happen without inclusion. So there's something to think about. If you want links to any of those papers, go back to the blog, because of course, all of these episodes come out of the blog that I wrote on the topic. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll talk to you next time. And that's it for this week's episode of the Digital Identity Digest. If it helps make things a little clearer, or at least a little more interesting, share it with a friend or colleague and connect with me on LinkedIn at HL Flanagan. And if you enjoyed the show, do be sure to subscribe and leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find the written full post at sphericalcowconsulting.com. Now stay curious, stay engaged, and let's get these conversations going.